As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Manchester City beat Arsenal in the Premier League to leapfrog them at the top of the table. Has the momentum shifted from North London to Eastlands? We'll be talking about that huge match and some big games in the Champions League as well. But defeats for both Premier League sides as Spurs and Chelsea are beaten by a goal to nil on their travels. We'll discuss Paris Saint-Germain after their defeat to Bayern Munich and look ahead to some important games at the bottom of the Premier League this weekend. A huge clash between Everton and Leeds. And what next for Southampton in their new manager search as they go to Chelsea? This is The Game. Hello, welcome to The Game Podcast. I am Hugh Woozencroft. And of course, we begin with a huge game in the Premier League title race. It ended Arsenal 1, Manchester City 3. Manchester City returning to the top of the Premier League for the first time since November, leapfrogging the leaders Arsenal, or the then leaders Arsenal, with a vital victory at the Emirates. City on top on goal difference, but they have played a game more. And we begin this discussion with Tom Clark, who's here to discuss that match with us. Tom Roddy will join us shortly from Dortmund to discuss the Champions League, alongside Gregor Robertson and Ian Hawkey as well. So plenty for us to discuss and in great company as well. But let's start with this game at the Emirates, as I say. Tom Clark, a game that in many ways was decided by errors. What did you make of it?
Yeah, you're right. It was decided by errors. I would say the first error from Tomiyasu is very much a self-inflicted one. I would say the other ones in the second half were more brought on by City's improved pressing. I thought there was a marked difference in the way City played, not just tactically, but in terms of their intensity and where it was targeted first half v second half. I think first half, Arsenal controlled the game, really. They were getting through that City press pretty easily. Their passing was really, really top-notch. I thought they put together some incredible flowing moves. But as Martin Samuel's written in the Times this morning, this is why Pep Guardiola is Pep Guardiola. He makes changes. He makes some kind of slightly bizarre tactical tweaks at times, but this is why he's a top class manager, because he works out how to get the best out of his team in these scenarios. Because as Jack Grealish said, I think Arsenal were the better team for large parts of the game, but at the same time, it's one of these strange games where you could say, okay, well, City deserved to win overall at the end of 90 minutes. If things like Bernardo Silva's role in the whole game was fascinating, and if listeners check the Times after listening to this podcast, we've got a piece kind of detailing how his movements around the pitch from left back to defensive midfielder to right winger kind of showed how Guardiola manipulated the game, and also how I don't think you need to play that well or that effectively but still triumph. I think Bernardo Silva was perhaps a kind of symbolic player for City's performance, in that he ran around a lot, he played it at a high intensity, he kicked Bukayo Saka and ended up on the winning team with a few kind of key moments in the second half. So it was fascinating. I'm interested to see what you all think about what this means for Arsenal, because I think there's a lot of discussion in the Times offices last night when I was working and this morning that kind of this is the wheels coming off. And I mean, listeners will know that I'm team Mikel Arteta all the way, so perhaps slightly biased, but it just doesn't feel like that to me. I think they played well. I think I know we're going to come on to the games that they've got to come, but I just don't see this as the kind of wheels falling off. It felt like they were kind of beaten by a more experienced, a more savvy team. And, I think that's how City played it. So I don't think this is the wheels coming off for Arsenal. I think that this was a very tight game, that Arsenal played very well in the first half. City kind of used that kind of experience and that champions quality, as Henry Winter said this morning. But I still think this is going to be a very tight title race.
Just to answer that question quickly in terms of you know, what it means in the greater aspect. You know, managers over the years have said you'd rather be chasing, you know, not just in the Premier League, leagues all over the world, because I do think, you know, it takes away the element of having to really look over your shoulder, having to worry. I think takes a little bit of the edge of the pressure off, in that you're no longer the team to beat in many ways, and you now have a goal of chasing down someone else. Now, I know it's level on points at the moment, and Arsenal have the game in hand, so if they win that, they will be top, and they'll be back in that position. But there's a part of me that thinks, you know, so many people were saying last night, well, the reason Manchester City won is they've got the experience, they've won four out of the last five titles. And you kind of think, well, okay, then if Arsenal don't have the experience of leading from the front and taking it, you know, all the way to the final match to lift the trophy, then maybe it's better for them to almost, you know, not have to think about it going into games. You know, you just go out there, you do your stuff, you win the result and see where it takes you, as opposed to what we've had for so long, which is, are Arsenal good enough? Can they win the title? All the question marks on really when they're going to slip up. Well, I guess all of that is out the window now. So I don't know. Maybe it helps, and maybe I'm clutching at straws.
Well, we discussed it on Monday's show, didn't we, in terms of previewing this, and said whether, you know, this narrative of the season has been that Arsenal are out in front and the only way they'll win it is by staying out in front. And I actually think for us as well in the media, this is a great twist and turn moment, isn't it, that we're going to see now what Arsenal are made of, because, as you say, they're very briefly, and albeit only on goal difference, the chasers. And I think that might help them in terms of a young manager with a young squad who aren't experienced in winning titles. It might help them.
Arteta said it himself. He said, psychologically, there is a marathon still to go. So he recognises that there's going to be ups and downs between now and the end of the season. And I don't think they should be too disheartened by this. As Tom outlined there, they were the better side, or certainly, you know, the team that dominated the play more. And there were some strange things in this game in terms of, you know, I think City's possession was the lowest it's been under Pep Guardiola. I think it was 36% possession. They played quite direct for periods in the first half, up to Haaland, to kind of try and negate or play around or play over Arsenal's press. And then City just, again, to echo Tom, it was like, we saw a team who were going for their fourth title in 5 years against a team that's not, they're going for their first in just about two decades. I think you just saw them grow more, City, in the second half. But in terms of like expected goals, it was 1.8 to City, 1.6 to Arsenal, 10 shots Arsenal, 9 shots City. Like there wasn't much in it. Although Arteta was pointing to the mistakes as well that led to goals, and the chances they missed, City missed chances as well. It was about just those, you know, who delivered in the key moments. And, you know, there are a couple of things too. I think Arsenal's fans deserve credit, which might sound strange because they've taken some seriously deserved stick over the years. But even after Tomiyasu made that mistake, they were chanting his name and roaring them on. And even when they went behind, it felt like this is a kind of club that's been healed and united by this team. And they've really... they're doing it, although it was subdued at the end. There were, you know, kind of a realization that they have still got a huge mountain to climb if they want to win this league. And that mountain is to climb over is Manchester City. They were still right there with the team to the end. For me, the only thing is there's just been slight kind of cracks in Arsenal's defensive pairing, whether it's Saliba in the air or Gabriel in kind of clutch moments. You know, he gave away the ball, I think, for the second goal. Kind of grasp that kind of tussle he got in with Haaland. Haaland's a specimen, but I just think there's been, in the last few weeks, a few cracks showing there, and they've been outstanding, and they've had to be outstanding because that's been a weak point for Arsenal for a long time. But overall, like, they went toe-to-toe with them, and for periods they were better than City, so there's a long, long way to go yet.
Tom, there were a few moments during this game that fans were arguing about. I guess like every single game, there was a highly debatable penalty given to Arsenal for Edison's foul on Nketiah. I wonder what you made of that. I heard a lot of Arsenal fans reflecting on the fact that they felt Saka is constantly fouled in this game and many, many others. I wonder how much those things are worth debating now that we've seen the outcome.
It felt like a kind of natural, easy progression of decision-making, I think, both in the office, and we spoke to Peter Walton, who's our referee pundit as well, last night. And he initially, when we were talking to him, was saying, oh, I'm not sure about this. But I think, like a lot of people, gradually felt that the penalty was one of those that perhaps wasn't always given, but that maybe was a foul. I'm sure Gregor might have some views on that as a defender. But so that one didn't bother me too much in terms of the big topic of debate. Your point on Saka is an interesting one. You know, it's not the first time we've seen it. It's interesting to see that City did it. Bernardo Silva was right into him at all times, both completely fairly and at times unfairly. But that's part of being a top team. And I would say that, not that point in isolation, the point about Saka, but I think it links to a trend that perhaps is the only thing that you could say as a theme from these recent games for Arsenal, Everton, Brentford, and now Manchester City. All different teams, different ways of playing, but they've all kind of stopped them in a fairly... I'm hesitant to use this because it feels a little bit basic, but an aggressive way. They've really, really gone at them and said, you've really got to battle past us if you want to play your wonderful flowing football. And I think that's the test for Arteta now. And in turn, it's meant that Arsenal have slightly lost their way at times. I think against Everton, they couldn't break them down. Against Brentford, you know, it was a battle back and forth all the way to the end. And against City, I think what happened in that second half, you know, Gregor alluded to it there as well, they kind of got distracted by the battle rather than making the way they played part of winning the battle, if that makes sense. They got distracted by the battle. There was the VAR decision, which kind of, even though it went their way with the penalty, the Haaland penalty, it didn't seem to help. It seemed to kind of distract them from their game. And it just felt like, even at 2-1, it felt like Arsenal weren't going to get a chance. It felt like they'd lost that momentum of their wonderful flowing football that they played in the first half. So I would say that to the Saka point, that's perhaps the only interesting thing that we can take as a theme going forward, that yes, he is their best player, and yes, teams are going to try and stop them by kicking him. But broader than that, that is how the opposition are maybe going to look at Arsenal. It's far more sophisticated than they don't like it up them. But basically, I think there's an element of distract Arsenal with a battle and they might stop playing their wonderful football.
I think Silva could quite easily have been booked before he was in the first half.
Yeah, I think if he'd been a left-back playing for Burnley or Stoke or someone and not called Bernardo Silva, I think he could have got two yellows as well, yeah.
Maybe, yeah. Also, like, just not to linger too long on that point, it's hard to overstate how unconventional what he's been asked to do is. Like, Martin Samuel, I've had referenced this in his sort of intro in his piece today, and I was fascinated watching that moment on the sidelines in the first half where I think Kyle Walker had been poleaxed basically and was lying on the floor. And Guardiola took that as a moment to bring over Silva, was it Rodri, and someone else. And he was kind of, oh, Anaki, because that's the kind of little trio, that little triangle between the left side of centre half, Silva, if you can call him, the left back, and Rodri in midfield, and how they interact and how they move to close down either the midfielders inside or Saka. And he was, you know, he was waving his arms around so passionately, and somebody got it wrong at one moment. He's like, no. And then you saw, they analysed it really well in the studio as well, that there were moments where Silva was from left back charging inside in field to close down maybe Odegaard or, you know, somebody, the midfielder, advancing midfielder. And as a left back, a former left back, it's hard to overstate how wrong that would feel, like exposing yourself, you know, going out to and leaving a gap for the winger to exploit. But they know they have a kind of, clearly they've worked on it, they have relationships, that Aki would then be the one to close down Saka. And that's why I said, after being at the Etihad on the Sunday, that there were times, I said this on Monday, there were times where it looked like Silva was playing as an auxiliary centre-half, because he does. It's almost not important whether he's filling in at left-back or he's filling in at centre-half, as long as the nearest man's closing the ball down and they're covering each other covering each other's space. It's extraordinary. I know that the kind of modern fullback is becoming a lot of different things, but this has almost taken it to another level. And part of that is because the man doing it is an out-and-out midfielder. You could say Zinchenko does the same for Arsenal, but it's not quite the same. I thought that was an absolutely fascinating aspect of the match. And quickly on the penalty, my instinct at the time was, if the forward gets off a shot and the goalkeeper or defender's action after that is not reckless, not really endangering the opponent, I don't like to see it given. But I can have... You can also, from Arsenal's point of view say that it was a foul, and so you can't be too upset to see it given.
Gregor, how much did Arsenal miss some of their key players in this game? Because you almost get the indication that the depth of City's squad and the quality there in some ways is the difference. I know Martin Samuel's written about Guardiola being the difference, but Thomas Partey, Ben White, Gabriel Jesus, I think for a lot of Arsenal fans, his absence was maybe exposed a little bit by, you know, in the Nketiah misses, but maybe just a more general lack of involvement as well. I don't know what you make of that.
Yeah, I mean, Nketiah, again, we're talking about these games being won in clutch moments. Nketiah's header in the first half, that was a glorious chance. Another that was flashed across the box and he didn't quite get in the end of. But you have to say he almost scored a goal to win the penalty. He had another in the box where he couldn't quite get the ball out of his feet, get the shot off. I don't know, you just don't really see, I suppose you could say the same of Haaland, but you don't see him that much in general build-up play, and I didn't think it was his best night. And Partey, I've kind of banged the drum all season saying he's one player that they really can't replace, and Jorginho is someone they brought in January to give them another option there after Elneny's injury, but undoubtedly they were weakened. And Tomiyasu, from a defensive point of view, he's really solid. I also don't think he got the credit in the first half for Haaland's kind of back post shot. I think he got a little flick on that and it wasn't really noted. He got a slight touch that put Haaland off and meant he kind of dragged his shot across goal instead of probably on target. He's a really good defender, and Arteta said he's never seen him make a mistake like that in 7 years of having watched him, and that was a bad time to do so. So yeah, you look at Arsenal's fill-ins, if that's the right word, you know, the players that are coming in, and they're not
the replacements. Replacements
the better word. Yes, they're not of the same level. That's a fact, and we've known that for a long time. Arsenal have to be lucky with injuries this season, and they have been, generally speaking. I think probably just that kind of step down in quality showed.
Do we all kind of agree that momentum shifted? In fact, does anyone think momentum shifted in this game? I guess I've pointed out already, I think there's a long way to go, and I don't necessarily feel like Arsenal are in a worse position mentally. I know a lot of people were using this game as a kind of massive psychological barometer of what's to come. I'm not too sure about that. Tom?
Yes, well, I mean, I've managed to stay Team Arsenal and Team Mikel through this little run they're having, but I will buy into the idea that maybe they're in a bit of a bad way if they don't get a result against Aston Villa. It's tough for them as well because it's away from home. It's the early game. Maybe Gregor would say as a player, when you're on a bad run, you just want to get out there. Because I think the other thing is, to me, other than Everton, I think they're still playing quite well, particularly last night. So actually, away at Aston Villa becomes a huge, huge game. And I would say as significant as playing against City. If they win that, everything's back on track. And that kind of momentum that you're talking about perhaps hasn't seesawed too much towards Manchester City. But it's absolutely vital that Arsenal put in a performance and probably get a win against Villa on Saturday. Because then otherwise, even people like me might start saying that the wobble is really here.
Huge game against Villa at the weekend, Ian. They need a bit of a favour, don't they? From their old mate Unai Emery. Villa haven't been great, particularly in their last game, but he has brought a huge air of positivity in terms of the way that they've played and some of the results that they've picked up. They'll want to bounce back. They will want to put a spanner in the works as well. I'm sure Emery himself would love to get one over on his old side.
He certainly would. He's quite a generous soul, Unai, and he's quite close to Arteta. But there's some unfinished business between him and Arsenal for sure. Just on the points Tom and Gregor were making, the idea that Arsenal might be bullyable, you know, looking at their last three games and how they were taking it on then. I mean, clearly the players who will be coming back at some point are an obvious solution to that, aren't they? Partey, Gabriel Jesus, the way he's been physically so imposing since he moved to Arsenal. But certainly, Emery will have looked at how people have taken Arsenal on in the last three or four games, and I wouldn't be surprised to see some more of the same.
Partey is the key figure in that respect. And as Ian said, Jesus as well, you know, I kept describing him as like a street fighter on the pitch in his start to Arsenal's career. And I know we always saw that at City, but it's that kind of that little dash of menace that he carries as well, and, you know, throwing his weight into challenges, and so good at holding the ball up and spinning and bringing people into play. But it's, you know, how aggressive he is as well. Undoubtedly, the return of Jesus will be a huge boost. And I think the Arsenal, they really do have to win against Villa, because at the moment we can say that we knew that this kind of little clutch of games could be season defining, and it's not gone well for them, but they're still in a brilliant position. If they don't get a result in the next game, that would be 5 games, I think, without winning all competitions. And then you are talking about a real wobble and a big test of character. This is already a test, but it can be kind of put to bed and throw the focus towards the future again with a win against Aston Villa.
Okay, one of the games that I guess we'll be looking at on Monday. A disappointment for Arsenal in midweek, but Manchester City with a huge victory. And of course, they will play at the Etihad, and that will be maybe the key game now in terms of the title race. Okay, plenty more still to discuss when we get back. We'll be talking about the Champions League with Spurs and Chelsea in action, a big game between PSG and Bayern Munich to react to as well. That's next on the Game Podcast. Well, I would say the problems mount for the Chelsea boss Graham Potter, except I'm not really sure what level of pressure he's currently under. It's now 2 wins in 14 in all competitions for Chelsea. That's after Karim Adeyemi scored a lovely solo goal to condemn them to a 1-0 defeat in the Champions League last 16 first leg at Borussia Dortmund. A raft of missed chances, I think, for Chelsea to rue in this one. João Felix shooting over, hits the crossbar as well in the first half. Ian, it's 7 straight wins in all competitions for Dortmund, and yet for many, it's quite a surprising result. What did you make of it?
It was a great watch, I thought. Really entertaining game. Chelsea, you have to adopt different criteria now, don't you? Because, you know, every sign of progress is to be welcomed, and, you know, it is a thing that has been thrown together on the hoof, at least for immediate purposes. And so you judge them according to different standards. But there were so many signs and moments of players who haven't come to terms with one another yet, and a manager who is still working out how to best use them. There was around about the hour just before the goal, actually, Enzo Fernandez, I think, because Mudrick was getting in his way, he fired a rather tame shot just wide, and it was a real sort of moment. And then very, very soon afterwards, there he was, last line of defence against a very, very, very fast counter-attacking forward. And, you know, he came out of that looking totally vulnerable, and inevitably, because he's new and he's very expensive, a little bit lost and bewildered. And that summed up for me an aspect of Chelsea, who nevertheless had, I think, 21 shots, was it? You can see what they could become, and could become in a reasonable space of time, but it's still got to be worked out.
What did you think of Chelsea's performance, Tom? You were there in Dortmund.
Afterwards, Graham Potter said a phrase that he's used quite a few times since becoming Chelsea manager, and which I think has started to grate on quite a few Chelsea fans, and that's that it was a step forward, the performance. And of course, in defeat, I think that irritates quite a few people. But actually, I do think it was. I was at the West Ham game on Saturday, and that was probably the first time we really saw the potential of this new Chelsea. The 25 minutes in which Mudrick, Felix, Enzo Fernandez all really started to click, and they showed real huge potential. Then, yeah, that West Ham score, and Chelsea just wilted. They showed such a lack of character, and that's at the London Stadium, where there is no there is such little atmosphere because of the stadium and the environment that allows. And then last night at probably one of the most hostile environments you could have, a superb atmosphere at Signal Iduna Park. They go behind, and actually, I thought they got even better after the goal, to be honest. They showed character, which is the thing that I actually think they have missed since Graham Potter came in. And not because of him, but because of the fact there's so many... It is almost like a brand new club. Every department has changed, had huge overhaul. So it's like pulling together a brand new club overnight, mid-season. And you get managers talk about the difficulty of coming into a club mid-season. But this has been a complete overhaul. So actually, they're not out of the game, or out of the tie, far, far from it. And there are signs to suggest that they can still progress. But the one kind of curious thing I found from last night, after all this money that's been spent, the approach they seem to have quite often was with wing backs, and Hakim Ziyech was a right wing back, cutting in on that lovely left foot he's got and crossing into the box. But who's he crossing to? It was Kai Havertz, who, with the best will in the world, has very rarely been much of a physical threat in the box, likely to get onto crosses, and it just didn't work out, that approach.
It's crucial that Chelsea get Reece James and Ben Chilwell playing somewhere close to their best soon as well. I mean, James obviously coming back from they're both coming back from injuries. James made one surging run in the second half that was magnificent, and he was halted kind of just on the edge of the box. Those two players were so crucial for Chelsea under Thomas Tuchel. So I think, you know, at least they're both fit now, getting them up to speed quickly is important. But Tom's right, look, that's their third goalless game in the last four. You still can't believe that Chelsea have scored 23 goals in 22 Premier League games. Like, that's less than half of Arsenal. He has to find a way to remedy that. And I know that sounds like it's not straightforward. And it is remarkable that they spent so much money and none of it's been on a genuine centre forward. And people can point to Aubameyang. I think we're beyond that. Aubameyang sitting at home, we're beyond that. I think his face doesn't fit, and it's always easy to find a solution in the player that's sitting at home or sitting on the bench or is injured. But he's done very little to suggest that he is that solution while he's been at Chelsea as well. So, but we come back to that point. Potter has to find a way to make Chelsea score the goals they need to win games, because he needs to start winning games very soon. And Havertz doesn't look like he's, as Tom said, he's going to be the guy to do that. Felix looks like he will score goals. You know, he came so close two occasions last night, particular. And I think their expected goals was 2.2. But it's becoming a recurring theme, and they need to do something to turn these chances into goals.
Yeah, they've the statistic about the goals they've scored is even more damning if you just look in the recent period. They've scored four goals in 13 games. But the statistics do... This is why I expected goals. It can be quite instructive with issues like this, where they scored three against West Ham, but had two disallowed. They had one that was inches away from going in last night, cleared off the line. Felix hits the crossbar and shoots over. It feels like they're so close to getting there. Like, it is so close to tricking. And I just wanted to go back to the point I made earlier about character. Actually, Gregor mentioned the return of Reece James, and I think he brings and Enzo Fernandez bring a real sort of grit and fighting spirit to this Chelsea team that I think they lack when those two players aren't there. Immediately, as soon as Enzo came into this team, he's looked like a warrior. And there have been a few Chelsea players that they've signed, and even just away from the pitch, the focus from the focus on them has made a few, it's been a bit overwhelming for a few players. But then Enzo, when he came in, Mudryk, when he came in, immediately both of them were seen as totally capable of dealing with it. And they've done, they have had a really good start considering the expectation and the focus on them.
You mentioned Mudryk and Enzo there, and you know, that's the impression I get. What about João Félix? I mean, it's easy to say because of his peculiar situation in that, you know, he is not a permanent signing. He's got a massive price tag on him. He's in an awkward situation in that sense. He sometimes looks to me as if he is auditioning, you know, that there's a bit of anxiety in his game. And you can easily say that when, you know, the chances that should go in are missed. But there seems to be, a haste about him in key positions. I mean, I think he's been, you know, he's been, in a way, he's been the most impactful in terms of you know, his creativity, his absolute enthusiasm for showing for the ball all the time. But how do you interpret his situation at the moment and beyond the summer?
Well, there's actually a bit of an irony, I find, in that all this money they've spent in the last year, and probably the best player they've got, they don't actually own. Because he's been, especially in that hour that he had at Fulham in Craven Cottage, he was just electric. And you'll know more than me, Ian, but he looked liberated of playing under Simeone. And the Graham Potter is probably the antithesis of Simeone in many ways. And he's just had a bit of a license to play freely. The one thing I thought at Fulham, and even more at Fulham than recently, but he looks like he's missing a striker to play off. He looks like a superb number 10 who can dart in and around a centre forward, essentially. And I do wonder, maybe they won't. It felt very final last summer, but I do wonder whether there would be any temptation to look at Romelu Lukaku this summer, bringing him back, giving him a try, because this isn't the Chelsea that where it collapsed and was such a failure for him. He's a real confidence player. And Gregor mentioned, there's a lot of talk of Aubameyang, and I agree. I think that ship has sailed. I don't think he is the solution. When he was in the team, he wasn't looking like the solution, but Lukaku at his best and playing under a manager like Graham Potter, who is not so harsh on him, I think it would be worth exploring.
And how do you think the fans would react to that? Because Lukaku did get a bit grumpy, didn't he, towards the middle of the last season, and speaking very fondly of wanting to go back to Italy and so on.
Maybe it is a step backwards, but it just seems like considering the expense of getting him off the books, and the one player that, watching last night, the way Ziyech was crossing the ball in, and I thought it felt like that summer again where they were missing the missing piece of the puzzle, Romelu Lukaku, and it wasn't, but whether it could be this time, but maybe it is the wrong thing to do to take a step back. But I don't think, and also I don't think this club at the moment is afraid of making decisions that will upset fans, to be honest.
Tom, very quickly, I know you're out in Dortmund. I do want to reflect on an interview that you've done in the Times with the former West Ham and Ajax striker Sebastian Allaire, who returned this year after a chemotherapy treatment for cancer. What was that experience like?
Very moving to begin with, first of all. It was one of those real privilege moments to sit and talk with Sebastian Allaire about what he'd been through in the last 7 months, and really quite inspirational, to be honest, because he clearly had this real bright, optimistic outlook that everything was going to be okay, and really impressive as well in the way that there was never a moment where the way he speaks, there was never a moment where he expected things to not go his way. But that the impact on his family, spoke about the preparing his mum, Simone, she was back in Paris, and when he first found out about it after, and it's worth pointing this out because it is a recurring theme in these stories, that it was a late diagnosis. He felt it began in May when he felt stomach issues, but he kept putting off checking it, and finally when he did, during the pre-season tour in Switzerland, discovered that there was a tumor pressing on his abdominals. It was testicular cancer, and just the way he approached it was so strong-minded. And there was one quote that really, really stood out to me from the time I spent with him, which was where he said that this is part of my story. It is a chapter in the story, but he said that he wouldn't let it define him, and you have to turn the page as well. So even though it is part of his story, he wants to move on now. It was a real privilege to listen to him. And of course, not that anyone deserves to go through anything like this at all. But I spoke to a few people, as you tend to do before interviews. I spoke to a few people beforehand. He was built into this image of just a brilliant character. There was one person I spoke to who works in football, and they went to go and they were attempting to sign him when he was 21 years old. Went and met him, pitched their club to him, 15 minute slot to meet him. It's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Finished the pitch, and they were just about to leave, and Calais said, "What time's your flight?" "It's 7 o'clock." "And what are you doing until then?" I said, "Oh, nothing." And he said, "Well, me and my family play Uno. So if you just stick around and play Uno with us." So spent the afternoon playing Uno with Sebastian and his family. And just little stories, little anecdotes like that, and colouring the image of what someone's like. And he was a real pleasure to speak to, real warm, engaging company. And it was a subplot last night. It's incredible to see him back playing, and it didn't really work out for him at West Ham, but he is a very good striker, and it's just great to see him back and very quickly getting to full fitness again.
I completely agree, Tom, and it's an interview that you can read on the Times app right now, so do check it out. Tom Roddy in conversation with Sebastian Allaire. But after that defeat, I think Chelsea will remain confident that with that home leg to come at Stamford Bridge on March the 7th, they can see themselves through to the quarterfinals. Tottenham Hotspur will also have to produce a comeback in the Champions League if they're to reach the last eight, after Brahim Diaz gave AC Milan a narrow win in their first leg at the San Siro. Antonio Conte's Spurs looked relatively comfortable, actually, for long periods against the seven-time European champions, especially given it was quite a youthful pairing of Pape Sarr and Oliver Skip in midfield, deputising for Pierre-Emile Højbjerg and the injured Rodrigo Bentancur. So in the end, it was a positive defeat for Spurs in many ways. I think there are many taking positives from it. It could have been worse. One of those, I think. What did you make of it, Ian? Because a lot was said about maybe Spurs not being at their absolute best and lacking quality. And AC Milan have had a very difficult start to the year as well. Just 5 points from a possible 18 in Serie A, dropping to fifth in the table. In some ways, was this not an elite matchup in the Champions League last 16?
Yes, you'd probably say that at a whisper, but yeah, I did two
two flawed teams a little low on confidence, and I think that showed, didn't it? That Milan have had a real, you know, fall from grace this year, and you know, some crossed words in the dressing room and so on. And I think you know that they were thrilled to get a win. Whether they genuinely feel it might be enough over two legs is another thing. One of the peculiarities of dropping the away goals rule is that, you know, people take, there's a slightly different perspective, isn't there, at the halfway stage of these games. You know, you can see Chelsea and Tottenham, I think both quietly confident that being 1-0 down with a home leg and a home crowd to come will, you know, is a reasonably comfortable position. And I think they're probably right. I think Milan are very flawed. I think they're showing some of the symptoms of youth. It was a strength last season in a fairly patchy Serie A. They had verve and they had a bit of sort of bumptiousness about them. But they make too many mistakes overall.
While we've been speaking, actually, the Spurs head coach Antonio Conte, we're told, will remain in Italy at his family home after a post-operation check following that recent gallbladder surgery. So assistant Christian Stellini will assume charge once again in his absence. A Spurs statement saying, following that routine check, he will stay at home, Antonio Conte, to recover from his recent surgery. Health is the most important consideration. Everyone at the club wishes him well. So that's a bit of a blow for Tottenham Hotspur. And once again, I think adds to the weight of feeling that maybe Antonio Conte will be looking for something else than Spurs at the end of this season. He's had so many, I guess, hurdles to deal with off the pitch in particular, but also on it in terms of how his team has played and the recruitment at the club too, and news this week, or at least reports that there are interested parties when it comes to Tottenham Hotspur as well. So we don't know necessarily what the future of the club will be, although the club themselves deny any approaches and say that the club is not for sale. But you feel like you're hitting some kind of junction when it comes to what is next for Tottenham Hotspur. That will be a big blow to them, Ian.
Yes, it would, in terms of continuity and, building a project, so to speak. You know, their turnover of managers has been quite high in the last 5 years. You talk about junctions. Antonio Conte is a manager of many junctions. He's got a sort of inbuilt restlessness about him. At the same time, I think we should take at face value his remarks this week that, you know, Italy is home and he feels a sense of belonging in Italy. You know, given what's happened to him personally with friends passing away and a medical issue.
The choices for Antonio Conte are all slightly complicated. If he's genuinely concerned about the future ownership and direction of Tottenham, then he would be equally concerned were he to look at Juventus at the moment, with several legal issues hanging over them, carrying possible penalties. And of course, they are now in a very difficult position if they want to qualify for the next Champions League, because they've had a points deduction. Inter will always have a soft spot for Conte, but they're not in the best of health and don't have the sort of economic muscle of a leading Premier League club. So the idea that he will go to Italy and find an improved professional situation at a club there is certainly very questionable.
And just going back to AC Milan, how important do you think this victory was for them?
Oh, in terms of morale, yeah, important. I mean, they are in a struggle to qualify for the next Champions League, and given that they won their first title for more than a decade last year, they want to feel progress, and of course, you know, they want to honour their status, however historic it now seems. But as I say, I think I'd be surprised to see them come away from Tottenham with a win, and I think Tottenham should have enough to get through that tie.
Okay, then let's move to the big tie this week. Anyway, we've got Liverpool against Real Madrid to come next week. The 10-man Bayern Munich holding on for victory over Paris Saint-Germain in France. They take a lead back to Germany in 3 weeks' time. PSG's midfielder Warren Zaire-Emery became the youngest player ever to start a Champions League knockout stage game. 16 years, 343 days, which is unbelievable. We also saw Kylian Mbappe come into this game, but clearly isn't 100% fit. And there are issues at Paris Saint-Germain, or I guess a club of their size and the way that they've been over the years. You would call it a blip, maybe, Ian. They've had losses to Marseille in the Coupe de France, Monaco in Ligue 1, another defeat here. Does that pile pressure on the manager, Christophe Galtier?
Undoubtedly, yes. Undoubtedly. And, you know, this is a trigger-happy club when it comes to coaches. He, in a sense, he doesn't have the cachet that some of his predecessors had behind him. He's very good, and he's been, you know, he's achieved significant things within France, but it is just within France. He's under huge pressure. You know, defeated in three different competitions in the space of what, a week. That's not what the dominant club in France are supposed to do. And I thought they were wretched actually against Bayern. Bayern were good and not brilliant. And you know, where do you start? It's extraordinary, isn't it, that a team with Lionel Messi, who fresh from winning the World Cup, looks around and thinks, "Oh, we only have one possible match winner, and it's not Messi. It's a guy carrying an injury off the bench." You know, given the resources they should have, and as I think you implied, probably their best player overall on the night was a 16-year-old. Yeah, I mean, it's they can be mind-boggling, PSG. And yes, they will do everything they can to have Mbappe fit in Munich, which does pose a danger, and he could, with the right service and peak fitness, turn the tie around. But I think it doesn't take much for PSG to start navel gazing and certainly start blaming the head coach. The one thing Galtier has is, I think, the confidence of the dressing room, which is important because they speak loudly. And he came in as part of a package with the effective sports director Luis Campos, so he might not be quite so disposable for that reason. But yeah, it's a big test for him, and I think people are curious to see how he responds.
He's got to be given time. I mean, surely they can't keep chopping and changing managers. It hasn't worked. So I'm hoping that Christophe Galtier does get some time. But whether it means that Paris Saint-Germain will get that elusive Champions League, I'm not sure. Very, very tricky now for them going to Bayern Munich, who haven't been beaten since September the 17th. I'm not necessarily sure Bayern Munich are as good as Bayern Munich's of old, but I'm not necessarily sure this Paris Saint-Germain team is much better than the Paris Saint-Germain teams we've also seen in the last few years. I'm not sure about this Messi axis, as great a player as he is, with Neymar and Mbappe. It's a dream team on paper, but it just hasn't clicked, and it feels like we'll come to the end of the road with that experiment very soon as well.
One thing that does do is leave us with no clear favourite. It's very hard to pick a favourite in this. You look at Real Madrid with their record in the Champions League. You can never rule them out, but they're not enjoying a brilliant season in La Liga. As you see, there's so many flaws in the other sort of main protagonists, included Liverpool, included Manchester City, included. Although we are wondering now whether they're about to hit their stride. So it's certainly hard to call this year, very hard.
Yeah, I think it's. At this stage, it's easy to say halfway through the last 16. But yeah, it does look potentially a bit more open. And there's the most brilliant team in Europe, statistically, is Napoli, and they can almost not bother with Serie A now. So that means they can concentrate resources on the
Champions League. They've got a very winnable tie against Eintracht Frankfurt. And, you know, that would be fun. That would be a refreshing presence in the later stages. Benfica, despite losing Enzo Fernandez, are in very good form domestically and very comfortably saw off Scott Parker's Bruges on Wednesday night. They're 2-0 up in their legs. So yeah, I agree with Greg. It does look open and with the real possibility that, you know, come the last four at least, we might have a relatively unfamiliar name.
Well, plenty to come, of course, in the last 16 of the Champions League. More games next week as well. As I mentioned, that huge game between Liverpool and Real Madrid. I wonder what we'll get there. So plenty, of course, for us to discuss in this competition. But up next, we will head back to the Premier League with a couple of massive games at the bottom of the table.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, just about time on the Game Podcast to discuss this weekend's Premier League games. And I wanted to focus in, of course, on the two teams towards the bottom of the table, searching, possibly still searching for a new manager. Who knows what decision these two clubs will make? Looks like Jesse Marsh will not be taking over at Southampton, as we thought the last time we spoke. They go to Chelsea this weekend with assistant manager Ruben Selles leading the team. Is currently favourite to get the job longer term. Now, if it is to be Selles, relative unknown, what does that say about the club's ownership group, Sport Republic, and the decision that they made bringing in Nathan Jones, but then sacking Nathan Jones? Of course, that wasn't going well for anyone, and we understand why he lost his job, but the succession planning clearly wasn't there. The sacking has been made, and we'll come to Leeds United, who are in a very similar position in a moment. What is happening with Southampton's dugout, Gregor?
Well, you talk about succession planning, and you know, I suppose they're not really expected to have to plan for succession in quite so short a space of time. Look, Jesse Marsh going there would have been, I think it would have been, there were aspects of it that you could think that might fit in terms of another manager who, you know, on the back of Ralf Hasenhüttl, certainly, is all about high-intensity, full-throttle football. But clearly they weren't willing to commit to him long-term. And you have to say from Jesse Marsh's point of view that the last thing he needs is a kind of second dismissal in a short space of time in the Premier League. So, as I say, I think it's a bit... Clearly, they weren't expecting to have to do this. And whereas we'll come on to speak about Leeds now, I think their thinking is certainly a little bit more muddled. Southampton are looking around to try and find someone to help them survive just now. And they weren't expecting that they had to do that. So there are certainly many mistakes that Sport Republic have made in the year and a bit since they took over the club. but I would be slightly hesitant to say that having a plan in place for to replace Nathan Jones after a few months in charge isn't one of them. I think that probably the appointment of Nathan Jones in the first place, or I think almost it was a, you know, it was a, we've said it before, it was a decision that's taken to kind of appease the fans because the atmosphere turned so toxic, and they've got to take their fair share of responsibility for that. And the thing that they need more than anything is that atmosphere and that cloud to be lifted, and it needs to be the right man to do that, or probably our best placed with Selez, who's someone who's there at the club and has been there for a little while, and I think the fans will probably get behind, and the players know.
I think Southampton are very muddled, and I think that this Sport Republic has shown its inexperience actually in this whole period at Southampton, because even though Nathan Jones was a massive mistake, but at the same time, it's not one that everyone entirely saw coming, because there were other Premier League clubs who were looking at Nathan Jones as a potential successor should their manager go or be recruited by a bigger club. So he was hot property because of what he'd done at Luton. So I don't think there was that the appointment, a club like Southampton appointing Nathan Jones is a huge mistake. What I do think was that it was just the wrong time to do it. You look at the context and the surroundings, and hiring a guy who'd never managed in the Premier League to get you to survival was really incomprehensible. And I actually think looking at Jesse Marsh now adds to that as well. It's the same. Quite a few Premier League clubs have had some pretty muddled thinking, and I sometimes wonder whether it is the conversation we were discussing earlier about fan reaction, what fans expect and appeasing them. Because when you look at what Everton did when they got rid of Frank Lampard, the people they were looking at, Sean Dyche, Marcelo Bielsa, saw Rui Faria was interviewed, Duncan Garson's wrote in the Times, Davide Angelotti. I mean, you such a broad, vast range of experience, styles and coaching, and it's similar now. And I know we're going to go on to talk a bit more about Leeds, but just on Leeds as well, the fact that they got rid of Jesse Marsh without a succession plan in place. I know we talk quite a lot about the dark side of football, where you've got owners and executives and directors speaking to a candidate while another man is still in the job, and it seems a bit dark and sinister, but there's a reason for it, and that's because otherwise you end up in this position where you're betwixt and between, and results are sliding fast.
Yeah, that's the key difference. Southampton, they didn't expect they were going to be in this position, and their mistakes have been, they've been too bold, they've been too confident in their own processes and thinking, whether that's in recruitment of players or the manager. They've done too much too soon, I think. Whereas Leeds, you know, they had time to make plans to think about a successor, because it's never been great under Jesse Marsh. There was flickers of signs of a team coming together, and then regression. So they should have been more, you know, there should be more forward thinking in their part. And I personally think that this is another sign of Leeds as a football club that aren't particularly well run. They're quite impulsive, and I think their success rate with managers, as I said the other week, Bielsa was such a shot in the dark that if you take him out of the equation, and it was a kind of miraculous, you know, hugely enjoyable journey for everyone, if you take him out of the equation, I think Andrea Radrizzani and Victor Orta have been decidedly average in their running of Leeds United.
I think there's another factor too, which draws into what you've said. I think there's an assumption
at some Premier League clubs that because the Premier League is so lofty now and that the financial muscle is so great and it's you know, the land of milk and honey, hedge fund managers, a promising young coach from Europe will, you click your fingers and they will come running at any stage of the season to be part of the Premier League adventure. Now, Leeds have discovered quite awkwardly that that's not the case with two of the people they've approached to succeed Jesse March. And you talk to intermediaries, and I think there is this perception that you know, any promising up-and-coming coach who's succeeded elsewhere will immediately drop everything to come and join the Premier League. And it's not the case. You know, some of these young managers are good and up-and-coming because they plan carefully, and they also have confidence that better offers will come in the summer, which is when you want to start a new job.
It's a huge game for Leeds United this weekend, and it's an intriguing one as well. They go to Everton, massive for Sean Dyche, of course, but you know, Leeds United need to start picking up wins, and they just don't have a permanent manager, and are seeing them linked with the likes of Nuno Espirito Santo and Steven Gerrard now. I mean, again, it's just an indication of, you know, I guess the fact that the board really should be under fire, and I think you point really interestingly to the decisions of the past and maybe how fortunate they were with Bielsa, Gregor. But looking at this game, you know, and the way that Leeds started against Manchester United and the positivity there, ultimately they ended up in a defeat. They got a draw in the game before that, which is the first game after March's sacking, also against Manchester United. You look at Everton, who lost the Merseyside derby 2-0 on Monday night, and you think this game could be crucial to both of them staying in the Premier League. 3 points for both is essential, really. But also, when you think about the fact that Leeds will face Southampton after that, they need to inject some positivity and some form this weekend. How do you see this game going? Final word on it. Gregor, I'll start with you.
It has the makings of a humdinger. There's no shortage of commitment on both sides. And that's one thing you would say about these two teams. Everton under Dyche, yes, they lost to Liverpool, but there was no shortage of commitment and desire and all the things, the fundamentals that Sean Dyche demands. And you have to say, Leeds in their games since Jesse Marsh left, and even under Marsh, that's one thing you knew you were guaranteed. They had desire, energy, running. They were getting in your face. That was their identity. So, and there's a lot at stake in this game. So, absolutely, I think it could be a bit of a throwback almost. And I would probably favour Everton just because, look, they were playing against Liverpool, and Liverpool were much improved on Monday night. But they still, I think, they're kind of defensive resolve and their sort of their base now under Sean Dyche is going to be crucial. We've always said the question is going to be whether they can score enough goals, and they, you know, they were missing Dominic Calvert-Lewin in that game. That's a huge blow, but that start point, that defensive resolve is probably going to be the difference for Everton, I think. And Leeds United, while they have, you know, Crescencio Somerville and Nonto are showing in flashes of how exciting they can be, it's not always been consistent output from them, and they kind of are lacking an out-and-out goal scorer as well. So if you're asking me for a prediction, I would just edge Everton, but I think it could be a bit of a throwback, like lots, like blood and thunder, and I'm here for it.
You expecting blood and thunder, Tom?
I think Sean Dyche will be anticipating blood and thunder, and I think he is smart enough to have worked out ways to attempt to kill it, really, because I think Leeds will go into it expecting that, almost thriving off the idea of playing in this chaos in which they tend to do so well, and these hostile atmospheres. And yet, I think you will see a few of the Dyche dark arts in slowing down the game, killing it, frustrating, being frustrating to Leeds. And I agree with Gregor in that I think it'll be effective. I think Everton win this.
It's going to be an intriguing one. Ian, what do you think? What do you think about these two, three teams really, Southampton, Everton and Leeds, and their chances of survival now?
Well, I find myself thinking all the time, recently and certainly since Everton have replaced, I've got a new manager in, that neither Leeds or Everton will go down. But then, of course, you look at the table and you have to find somebody else. You know, I think that they've both shown quite enough to be positive about their prospects. But, somebody's got to go down. And I'm slightly with Gregor that I think at the moment, and for this fixture, you'd marginally favour Everton, which, you know, might be decisive in the race. My doorbell's just gone.
Saved by the bell. Ian Hawkey, thank you very much. We've come to the end of our time together. Tom Roddy out in Dortmund, thank you for taking the time to join us. Gregor Robertson and Tom Clark as well. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can get more of our great journalism right now on the Times app, in a Times newspaper. So download or buy wherever you can. You can also, of course, subscribe to The Game online, thetimes.co.uk/thegame, each and every Monday for you. Certainly make sure you pick up a paper if you haven't got a subscription. And if you don't want to miss an episode of the podcast, then just hit that notifications button and you will be notified every single time we release a new episode. The next one will be coming on Monday. We'll see you then. Take care.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.